Okay, so the Bat Segundo show is dead, but I couldn't resist one last interview just before the launch of Follow Your Ears, which is a new thematic radio show that's going to be an evolution of what I did with Bat Segundo. That should be launching next week, so stay tuned for that. You can go to followyourears.com for updates, but for those who are subscribed to this feed, I will keep it active. Anyway, this is a transitional show, and it involves an interview with Michael Apted, a filmmaker who you may know for Coal Miner's Daughter, but who is also responsible for this amazing series of films known as the Up series. Every 7 years, he meets again with a group of people and follows them over the course of years. And now he's on to 56 Up. So all of his subjects are 56 years old. This conversation got into a lot of interesting territory. We talked about the advent of YouTube and whether the Up films could compete in relation to that. We talked a great deal about selves, about what's being displayed on camera. And I think you'll see that it has a little bit of the style of the old Segundos while also representing what I'll be moving to with Follow Your Ears. In any event, I will let the interview speak for itself. Enjoy the show! Okay, so I am here with Michael Apted, who is most recently the director of 56 Up. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
So, there is a big question I wanted to ask you, and regrettably I did not talk with you for 49 Up, but during that particular time, we were in a stage where YouTube and viral videos were mere striplings compared to what they are now.
Right.
And this has led me to ask you, especially with these Up films, how a movie that deals with how humans evolve over nearly six decades of their lives, does a filmmaker like you compete with something like that, or reality television, of which, interestingly, Peter, one of your subjects, seems to be using some of the moves normally one would associate with reality television for you, of all people. So what do you do to adapt, or do you not really change up the setup you've had going now for several films here?
No, I think I've got one huge advantage over everybody. I am at least 30 years ahead of the game.
Uh-huh.
No one's got what I've got, you know, and I think that's what's unique about it. That's why, of all the work I've ever done, this is, to me, the most precious, because it is entirely original, and people have only copied it. No one has really come anywhere near to equaling it in longevity, nor do I think will they ever, because as much as you talk about modern media is nothing as unpredictable on marshy ground. Can sink and dive and whatever at the drop of a hat. There's about seven mixed metaphors in there. But the solidity which was in the broadcast world when we started, which guaranteed it at least into, say, 35 Up, without any question about, or should we do this, can we raise the money to do this particular version of it, has given me a running start. And I don't think anybody will ever catch me up. So I look at these newcomers with sort of in a blasé way and say, off you go.
But aren't you concerned with, for example, I'll give you one example. There's a viral video going around. It's amusing enough. It's a guy who is reviewing Five Guy burgers in the back of his car, and he goes, damn! And this gets remixed over and over. And then weeks later, we see that he's now a fixture on Jimmy Kimmel, and then he'll be forgotten. And whatever natural exuberance he had is almost stifled instantly. Yeah. And so, you know, yes, I grew up on the Up movies. I watched them throughout my life, and it's always a pleasure to go back every 7 years, and it's sort of like going to church, except on a seven-year schedule. But simultaneously, I mean, doesn't this bother you? I mean, how can you woo, for example, a younger generation of viewers when, presently, it's really all about reducing human behavior to novelties, to something that's kind of an ephemeral indulgence as opposed to, you know, really exploring the depths of someone?
That was a bit of a mouthful. I don't know. I suppose you're right. I've never lost the audience. I always thought I'd give the series up if the viewing figures dropped away, and they don't seem to have done. So whether young people are attracted to this, I don't know. It's almost staple, you know, stuff in teaching, you know, all sorts of sociology and whatever. You know, I don't believe everything just disappears with the bathwater. I think people do have a sense of the past and sense of history, especially when they cease to be teeny boppers and then become people with children and people with mortgages and all this kind of stuff. And this is the drama of, you know, this is, I call it the heroism of everyday life, this series. And I think everybody responds to that at some point. I mean, maybe nobody between the age of 11 and 25 will want to watch this, but there'll come a time when they'll discover it later on. And because it's, in a sense, without boasting, so rich, because it covers so much of people's lives, which no one else has ever covered, you know, I'm optimistic that it will stay around. So I don't feel threatened by it. I know what you mean about how can I attract a young audience competing with YouTube. I mean, this is all over YouTube from the minute I practically finished editing it, you know. So anyway, I mean, it's a good question, but I'm not worried about it.
So this seems to me a far more political installment of the series than previous ones. I mean, we have Jackie, who is on disability, and she excoriates Cameron at one point. You have Lynn, who we see after she has lost her job as a school librarian. This seems to be a great concern, at least on your part or the camera's part, on capturing the consequences of various austerity programs. And I'm wondering why the film tended to shift this way. I mean, these were going on under Thatcher. These were going on under a variety
of... Yeah, but you're missing the point. The point is that how does it affect their lives? I've never been interested in any of the series of objectifying politics. Politics only appears in issues when it affects their lives. Now, certainly Thatcher was doing all sorts of bloodthirsty work, but these people were very young then, and it didn't affect them. These people are now 56-year-old. Their pensions are going out of the window. Their salaries are going out of the window. Their future, their children, their grandchildren is going out of the window. So that's why it's in this film. I don't ask them political questions. They talk about it. Because I gave up asking politics in 42 up when I foolishly asked them about Princess Diane, who had just been killed, and I threw it out straight away because I was asking for their opinions on something that weren't organic to their life. I'm not interested in their political opinions. I'm interested in how politics determines their life. And in this generation of people living in the United Kingdom, which is going through a worse time than here, and will go through an even worse time, and you'll go through an even worse time, it's of profound importance to people's lives. And so my films, this generation of film, 56, reflects the personal effect of this political kind of, you know, fallout that's going on. But this is the first time this has ever really happened in the series, because I haven't found that politics has so interested or determined or, you know, concentrated itself in people's lives as it is now.
Politics is only a concern for the Up series when it is personal.
Yes, because the politics of the film are their lives. They are the political statement of the film. They're not objective opinions. I'm not interested in opinions. I'm interested in the organic manifestation of politics in people's lives.
I'm glad you brought up the Diana moments in 42 Up, which...
I thought I'd cut them out. Are they still around?
I had heard about this, you do leave the moment with Tony here where he is very defensive in relation to certain racist connotations of immigration. So in a situation like that, that's kind of a political...
But again, it's organic. It's about the culture he grew up in. It's about the society that he feels has been degraded, you know, where he grew up, his roots have been degraded by immigration. And, you know, I called him out on it, basically. And, you know, it was a pretty scary moment for him and for me. Should I ask the question? I thought, no, sod it, I will ask the question. Because I think it's the question everybody was asking. Is he racist or is he not? Does he have a fair point? Maybe he does. He has a right to express it. You know, people were turfed out of their habitats, you know, by a great invasion of people from, you know, other countries and whatever, and maybe he has a point. So with him, you know, the whole idea of racial integration is very, very crucial because it did transform the whole community that he grew up in.
How do you decide what questions to ask of the subjects? Is it largely intuitive?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly, you're still getting into trouble after all these years.
Yeah. It is intuitive, and it's it's, I wish I could think of an amusing way to express it, but basically I assiduously do not prepare for it. I do not go back into the old films. I do not say, oh my God, they said this in 49, what are they going to think about it now in 56? Because I've noticed over the generations that the films change tone. They're not the same films. And I thought the only way to preserve that is to make each episode as fresh as I can, to sit down like we are now and talk and not know which way the conversation's going to go and what you're going to ask me, what I'm going to answer, you have no idea. And that kind of spontaneity, I think, is kind of crucial because it's not predictable. Once this series becomes predictable, then I think I'm sort of dead in the water, and there's an element of predictability built into it, i.e. the whole idea that you, from the minute you're born, you know what kind of options you have. But given that, and that's become kind of less important again as the series has gone on, because English society, the society of Great Britain, has changed a lot. Social mores are much more flexible, education is much more flexible, and all this. These people came into life at a certain period of time when the English caste system seemed to be very, very strong. And there's still a class system, but it's changed. It's become more Americanized. It's more to do with money than it is where you were born. And whatever. So I've forgotten what the question I'm answering is now.
No, but I think I was very curious about forgetting the previous films.
Oh, yes. I mean,
there's this aspect, too. I mean, do you carry enough of a reliable familiarity with the material, or do you find that the relationships, both positive and fractious, are enough to steer you into the next installment?
No, it's both. I mean, I have a huge amount of information in the back of my brain. I mean, I know what the great iconic moments are, what each character, what's been their kind of few key moments, and I know that without having to think about it. But, you know, the provocative, fractious stuff that I have with them, I think that's what gives it life, and that you can only approach that by having a genuine conversation and surprising each other.
Because conflict is the stuff of drama, it should be the secret ingredient of your relationships with your subjects for the Up movies.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, there's lots of ground for conflict. There's an overwhelming sense of trust, which is why they're all in it, pretty much, and how it continues. But on the other hand, there's also conflict. There's a residual anger from them, I think, because they were, you know, they were press ganged into it. They didn't make a decision at 7 to do this. They didn't make a decision at 14 to do this. And then when they became adults, suddenly they were in the middle of this roller coaster and sort of stuck with it. So there's still an anger, I think, which I still find with them about that. But generally, I think that's been kind of now overtaken with a sort of a sense of a trust. And the trust they have in me is that if they've got something to say, I'll let them say it. And I'll answer it if I can, or acknowledge it if they're right and I'm wrong.
But Nick in this movie, he says, this is not a picture of me, it's a picture of somebody. He complains that he doesn't have any control of how he is actually being presented. Susie says, well, I don't think this presents a well-rounded picture of me. So it's very interesting that your subjects seem to complain, or at least I was more noticed. I noticed their complaints more this time than I did in previous ones, although you have had skirmishes with them in the past. I mean, what do you do to placate them? I mean, do you allow them to see elements of the film or how it's actually taking place? I mean, and of course, Charles, he threatened to sue you, and there's no trace of him in this movie. I was sort of surprised. I mean,
and do you know what his job is?
He's a TV producer. I know.
Documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, but does that recuse him of...
No, of course not. Makes it unforgivable. If you live by the sword, you have to die by the sword.
Yeah.
But you've asked me about 1,000 questions in the last 20 seconds, and I'm trying to figure out... I mean, what you missed out is the point that Nick is making. He's saying, no, this isn't a proper representation of me, but it's a representation of somebody, i.e., it isn't the details of him, but it's some iconic representation of what he stands for and who he is, which is all these things can be. Of course, how can I put people's lives into 18 minutes or whatever, however long I give them? Of course, it's my judgment, it's my taste, decide what goes in. That's true of any film ever made, whether it's a documentary. The only film that doesn't qualify is Andy Warhol pointing at the Empire State Building for 24 hours without changing the film. Everything is a cultural, a judgmental decision, and I make those. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but all I can say is they're all still here. They haven't been so offended by it that they've gone away and dumped me, as it were.
How much do they collaborate with you outside of being in front of the camera?
Well, it's in a sort of family sense, and don't throw up. You know, some we get on well, some I don't get on so well with, some I like to see, some like to see me. I live in California, some of them come out to America, they come and stay with me and all that. There's no formula to it, it's just a kind of personal thing, really. Some I speak to a bit, some I don't speak to hardly at all. But we keep an eye on them all through the intervening period to see how things are going. But it's never been objective. I mean, once we got through the first couple of generations, you know, I was clearly involved in their lives in a major way. I mean, not in a parental way or a blood way, but nonetheless, you know, I was part of their lives. And so it was hard to even contemplate some spurious idea of just visiting them every seventh year, just appearing like that and doing my snapshot, then disappearing for another 7 years. So that wasn't ever going to be on. So, yeah, we are part of each other's lives. And also, you know, the other thing is about it is there's a lot of self-editing goes on because I have to behave myself. If I'm making a documentary about you, I can tell you the most atrocious lies and mislead you and everything because I want to make this, I think, very important, powerful film about some aspect of your life, and I'm never going to see you again, and so I'll do whatever I want. I mean, you could sue me, but maybe, you know, that's too late. But with these people, I've got to behave myself because I want to go back next time. And if I, you know, misuse their trust or whatever, or use things they didn't want to use, ask them things that they don't want to be asked and all this, then they're going to lose patience with me. Yeah. And the same with them. I mean, you know, they can say to me, I want to see this. I want to see that you haven't used this bit which I didn't like. And what am I going to do? Not show it to them, you know? So there's a kind of built-in editing process going on between both them and with me to preserve this relationship, which needs to go on and on and on.
And yet Charles, I mean, he wants to sue you. Have you made any efforts to be, efforts at diplomacy, efforts to sort of woo him over?
No, actually not really. I did with Peter and it paid off. I mean, Peter dropped out at 28.
Yeah.
And I kept a relationship with him because we got on well. And I understood why he pulled out and we had a lot of mutual interests and like that. And I would always ask him to do it and he would also always graciously decline, etc. And then, you know, his musical career took a turn and so it became in his interest to be in the film, which is fine by me, but I think I was so angry with Charles in a very amateurish way. You know, I was cross with him because he is a documentary filmmaker. He's the last person I would think would turn me down, as it were. So I don't think it ended very well between him and me. And then he tried to sue us to get all his images taken out.
Yeah.
And the lawyers said, take us to court. We look forward to seeing you there.
But isn't it the documentary filmmaker's obligation to try to at least be transparent with the subjects and say, hey, you know, especially if you want to work with them again, I don't know, it would seem to me that you would want to be transparent about how they're being presented, sure, even with the flaws, and you may actually get them to participate in the truth-telling. Why do you think that there's some of this, you know, conflict or anger that especially it seems to be in the early years of the Up series that
well,
you
maybe explain that. I mean, yeah, that they had no choice in this and they were stuck with it. They had no choice in being part of it.
At what point did they have a choice?
Well, I suppose at 21 they could have said get lost.
Yeah.
But they didn't. What they're angry about is that, you know, their school teachers or parents railroaded them into it.
Yeah.
I mean, not that we knew what we were doing. I mean, we didn't know at 7 that this is going to be a lifetime's work. We thought it was one film.
Yeah.
You know, so there was no particular misleading. We weren't being misleading about it. We just didn't know. It kind of, the whole thing grew organically. It was never, no one sat down and said, let's take this life's work and do it. It was an accident, the whole thing. So there was no malice in it, but I could feel that they resented the fact and they like to bring that up now and again, that they didn't actually have a voice in being part of it. And when they were found themselves in the middle of this, they were somewhat trapped by it. You know, they would have to make a big decision to get out of it. It would be more difficult to get out than to stay in, if you know what I mean.
Sure. So persuading the subjects to appear at the age of 21 must have been one of the most delicate
Possibly. I mean, I don't remember it, but I know it's always been difficult. I mean, it's, you know, until recently when I suspect there's more sense of ownership that they have about it. And they now run it much more than I do. I mean, for example, there's, you know, a famous section in it when two of the characters had actually sat on the sofa talking to each other. Yes. And people think, oh my God, are they an item? And all this sort of stuff. But there was that was their idea to do that. I mean, and I thought, oh my God, is this a good idea? And I wasn't sure about it at all, but they wanted to do it, so I did it, and it worked out very well for me. But again, that was part of the fact that they seemed to be much more empowered, much more proprietorial about the thing. They want to decide what they do now. They won't let me say, I want you to film hanging upside down or doing jumping jacks or whatever. They'll say, no, I want to sit there and read Proust in the original French to show how smart I am. So whatever they want, I now do.
Yes. But Peter's MO is inarguably, first and foremost, to promote his band.
Of course, yeah.
So that's going to clearly get in the way of a more complete portrait of him. Yeah. And Neil, in fact, confronts you and says, you don't know anything about how I've lived or who I've been with or who I've dated. I mean, and we don't. And actually, when Neil confessed that in the film, I said, well, as interesting as Neil is, I really don't know what happens between the films. And, right. and it leads one to ask, well, are these little snapshots fair representations? Do you even know who these people are?
No, of course not. I mean, I've never met a girl he's been with, talking about Neil. Had I gone at a time when he was in a relationship, I'm sure we would have done, I'm sure. But again, you know, it's all happenstance in a sense. I mean, I pick this time every 7 years to go in, and I've only once ever veered off that. That was when Neil went to Bruce's wedding, and I wanted to get that. Otherwise, I've been really religious, because once you start doing what you're saying, where do you end?
Yeah.
If I'm going to start documenting 14 lives, I'll be buried under a mountain of, you know, a material more than anyone's ever achieved before, and I'd spend my whole life doing it. So there's something haphazard about the whole thing, something fortuitous. I go to some people when they're having a good time in their life, when they're a bad time in their life. But I think we all know that. We know that I don't spend every day of 7 years with them. So I don't think there's any sense of misleading an audience. There's something arbitrary about it, if you want. But nonetheless, what isn't arbitrary is the fact that we've been able to go back every 7 years in a regular way and check them out.
But do you think that the subjects are second-guessing you to a large degree? I mean, they've been at this game a number of times. They know that every possible grimace or expression or emotion or word is going to be dissected and analyzed by audiences upon audiences upon audiences. And when we factor in our present reality, which is walk down the street, everybody is documenting everybody with their smartphones. Anybody with a smartphone can be a documentary filmmaker.
Sure.
You know, the camera is inarguably a greater part of our lives. And in the case of your subjects, they're used to this, so how do we know that what we're seeing is true?
Well, it's always true, isn't it? Yeah. It's true now. I don't know whether you're bullshitting me, whether you're trying to be hostile to me or what. You seem quite aggressive. You don't know whether I'm lying to you, being defensive. I don't know. It's just something you feel in the moment, and it's something, it's the skill of interviewing. It's the skill of you. I have these 2 or 3 hours with them every 7 years, and I have to make the most of it. And I have to create an atmosphere of trust between us, and an atmosphere that doesn't feel loaded, that doesn't seem to be guiding, that seems to be able to get them to talk as though they were in their front rooms with a cup of tea and no one was around. And that's the skill of it. Now, I don't know. I've never known whether they're just lying in the back of their teeth. But that's your whole life too. You don't know. Every interview you've ever done might be a total sham from beginning to end. Isn't it? Isn't that possible?
It is possible.
So I don't know really what you're saying. You're saying everything that anybody who's in any form of communication with other people for a business, whether it's in business, broadcasting, whatever, always has to take the risk that they've been sold a shitload of lies, whether they like it or not. But I mean, I've often thought that. Are these people telling me the truth? But then I thought, does it matter? I don't know.
As long as you believe it, perhaps, that's what ultimately
matters. Yeah, I mean, if I think they're lying to me, I'll pull them up on it. You know, I think this is not true. But most of the time, like now, we sort of believe in what each other's saying, I think, don't we? I mean, we're getting on kind of well and in a kind of aggressive way, but I think, you know, that we probably think we're telling each other the truth. You know, and that's all you can do, I think, is just get a sense that you're getting somewhere. Because I also know that some of them in it, and you know better than I do who they are, will not tell me the truth. They will not reveal themselves. And I say this to them. I say, you're doing yourself a great disservice. You're not being open with me, and it's going to show. And believe you me, it does show. You, if you look at that film, we sat down together, you could tell me who's holding back on me, who's holding back on me, who's trying, who's struggling to be honest with me. And you'll know which is the more appealing. You know, not whether it's commercial or successful, what is it, what is a present representation of a human being more appealing when you have a feeling they're trying to tell you the truth?
Yes. So you will stop tape or stop film if you don't believe what they're saying?
No, I'll question them on film if I don't believe it. But on the other issue, when I think they're not telling me anything, when we stop, I'll say, look, this isn't going well because you're not telling me anything. I know that you're not being open with me.
Yeah.
And they may say, no, I'm not being open with you, and I'm not prepared to be open with you. I have to say, fair enough. And you'll find that their segments are very, very short. And the people who are open with me, who are interesting, will get much more airtime, not because I'm a bully, but because it's much more interesting. So I will come up to them and say, I don't think you're being open with me.
Yeah. I noticed that you credited yourself as researcher. Is that
only in 7-Up?
Oh, only in 7-Up, okay.
Yeah, we wanted to give the real credits for 7-Up.
Look, I see.
Paul Almond directed it, and myself and Gordon McDougall researched it.
Got it.
So that's only for the, I think it says 7-Up, directed by researcher.
Yeah, that's true. So the question is, I mean, do you do any kind of fact-checking whatsoever? Has it occurred to you to corroborate any of the details?
Yeah, no, we do that. Not necessarily to the extent that the New York Times would do it, but we do it. And, you know, usually we know enough about them, because we do keep in touch with them. I mean, I have someone, you know, Claire Lewis, who's worked with me since 28, lives in England, lives in the United Kingdom, and, you know, keeps in touch with them. And, you know, we keep track of them, so we know what's going on.
How much time do you have with them in between the films?
Well, I mean, if I see them, I mean, I like to do things for them. I mean, if I have a movie opening in London, I'll rent a theatre and get all them and their friends, because I like doing things for them, because I'm always a supplicant. I'm always asking for them to do things for me. But, you know, it's nothing I make a habit of. You know, I don't ring them up and say, I'm in London, let's get together. But if there's something I can do or help with, then I'll do it. So I'm not shy about involving myself in their lives if it's, you know, if it feels the right thing to do.
My understanding is that 49 Up, you had a difficult time of that. Have the Up films become more an obligation than a passion, or is it still?
Yeah. Oh, no, it's the most important thing I do. You know, it's my It's the most original piece of work that I've been associated with, and it's sort of mine, you know, and it's my sense of authorship about it is, you know, is very important to me, because I don't write my movies, so again I'm an interpreter of other people's material as a movie director or in television drama. But with this, I feel that this is what I was in a sense born to do. I was always nosy, I was always interested in other people's stories, I always was gossipy, I always wanted to listen to people's conversations in restaurants, and still do. I have a great love of history, which I got from my mother. I think the past is always with us. I don't believe that because someone has got the attention span of a flea now, that means they don't have a history, they don't have memories, they don't have texture to their lives. I've always believed that, and this is, in a sense, the quintessence of that.
I think it's a good place
that
to stop.
That was good, wasn't it?
Michael, yes,
Love
thank
me.
You very
that
much.
Good, that
yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you.